Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. 50 years ago today, the final link of the Gateway Arch was put into place, completing the iconic symbol of westward expansion. A little later in this program, we'll meet the daughter of the man who designed the classic monument. But first, a man who is also closely associated with construction of the arch, but for a much different reason. Percy Green is a longtime civil rights activist who engineered one of the civil rights movement's most memorable moments when he and a colleague climbed one leg of the arch, protesting the lack of blacks on the monument's construction crew. That was in 1964 and captured national attention. I spoke with Percy Green yesterday and asked him what he thinks today when he sees the arch.
Well, the thing that comes to my mind now that I have learned some of the history, the many displaced homes that made way, that made it possible for them to erect the arch. You know, before that, the arch grounds was considered as arch ground. People lived in that area. And then, of course, learning about how that came about, removing those people, and then, of course, the promises, the false promises that was made that it was going to, you know, create jobs, much of the same that we hear today when the city fathers wants to pass a bond issue or whatever. The first thing they do is talk about jobs and how this is going to vitalize the community and so on and so forth. But the important thing is that all those people were displaced.
40 acres of...
40 acres, you know. And it's almost like a urban renewal type program that we've come to learn about, and you know, since that time. And then, of course, business as usual as it relates to people of color. Blacks was not part of the employment scheme of things in terms of employment, nor were we employed in terms of contracts. In other words, no contracts. Blacks didn't receive any of the contract work as well.
Well, jobs, of course, are central to the reason for your demonstration there back in 1964.
Yes. Yes.
Before we get to that, Percy, give me some sense of the rest of the climate of that time. 1964, the civil rights movement was in full flower, just about to be.
Yeah.
What was the climate like here at that time?
Here in St. Louis? Oh, it was... it was bad. The interesting thing is that we had some fair-minded whites that was willing to work with blacks, many of whom were from universities. Many of them were from out of town. And then, of course, you had some locals. They were conditioned to realize, you know, racial discrimination in terms of public accommodation. You had a situation there at Washington University where my dear friend, who still is a still living name, Eugene Tenure, he's now in New York, but he was very instrumental working along with another associate of mine named Bob Curtis, and they worked toward breaking up some racial discriminatory practices in terms of restaurants. Santoria was a restaurant there, and they were in Washington, close to Washington University, and so they did some sit-ins and things of that nature. And then from there, they gravitated on to some other activities. Years later, you had Jefferson Bank, where it was considered as a black bank located in the black community, but then after so many years, they moved to a predominantly white commercial area, and then all of a sudden, the black employees, the few that they had, disappeared, and then that led to some protests.
Which turned out to be quite successful in terms of black employment
pictures. Yes, it stimulated a lot of blacks into positions other than the menial type jobs.
Give me some sense, if you would, of how this whole idea of the demonstration at the Arch came about. I mean, was there a moment when... And what you said or someone said, this is what we'll do. This will catch some attention.
Well, it came about right after the Jefferson Bank. After we were able to verify the four blacks that was demand of Jefferson Bank was truly in place, I then became chairperson of the employment committee for CORE. And then, of course, during one of the meetings, it was brought up about the Arch Project, and it was under contract. I mean, it was being constructed at the time. We felt as if now is the time to see whether there are any blacks working on the program or contractors, and if not, why not? And the best way to find that out is to confront the contractor. So we set up a employment committee. I was on the committee. I can't remember exactly the other people. It was about three or four of us, and we went to the contractor. The contractor name at the time was McDonnell, but they were not related to the McDonnell Aircraft people. Neither was the spelling of the name. And his position was that they didn't have any black employees at the time or contractors because he couldn't find any. And if we knew of any, to send them to him, and he would consider, but there's no guarantee that he was going to hire them. And we went back and forth on that for a couple of weeks. And then, of course, during the committee meetings, we've pointed out that while this is under construction, I mean, if they don't adhere to our demands, then perhaps we would have to conduct some form of demonstration. And then, of course, we had to do our homework first and foremost to see whether or not we could even get to the Arch. And our task, first and foremost, to see whether we could get to the Arch. Once we learned that we could, then, of course, we planned a demonstration only if the company was not going to hire. And then after the second meeting, he didn't give us any indication that he was going to hire any blacks or contract. So we then proceeded on with the demonstration. And, of course, we had to set up strategies and tactics. We had to set up a diversionary to be able to get on the grounds. And so the rest of it is history.
What was that diversion?
Well, the day that we decided to do the demonstration, we notified the press that we were going to have a picket line at the old courthouse. And the issue was jobs there on the Arch. And we couldn't afford to let them know that we were planning on climbing the Arch, because had we, they would have notified the police and we never would have been able to. So we utilized that to get the press's attention. And then, of course, if we were successful in getting to the Arch and climbing it, then the people that was there at the old courthouse would have notified the press and then direct the press or inform the press that we have two demonstrators on the Arch. And that's what happened. We then indicated, at that time they had binoculars there on the Arch ground where people could look over on the toward the Arch grounds and then to see the men working on the Arch. And so we used that same means to notify the press after our people notified that we was on the Arch. We signaled that we was up on the Arch. Then they transferred that information to the press, and then the press came over. And
The press was all over it.
They was all over it at the time. But interesting enough, as much footage and everything that they did of that demonstration, it's interesting that you can't find very much of it. I mean, that's kind of says something about the climate here in the city of St. Louis, that they didn't value demonstrations and things of that nature.
Yeah, I also know that using film in those days, film is very, very hard to preserve. It could be preserved, mm-hmm. but it was difficult.
It
had to be very carefully kept. Why did you decide to climb? I mean, you could have done any number of things. What was the decision like? Well, let's just climb the darn thing.
Well, first and foremost, we knew that if we climbed the Arch, it's very unlikely. We knew that we could have been there as long as we wanted to be there. They couldn't have done anything about us being there. without trying to risk their lives as well as the lives of the demonstrators. So we didn't think that that was likely. And so therefore we thought that this would have been the best kind of demonstration because we could have it would have lasted as long as we were willing to remain on the arch.
You chose the time, lunchtime, as I recall, because that was an easier time to kind of get access to the arch grounds.
Yes, most of the workers was at lunch at the time. And then, of course, the way demonstrators, protesters, our dress blend in with working with the workers. We always identified with the working class. And so we was able to walk right past the workers onto the arch. And once we gained access to the ladder, there was nothing that they could do but just wait us out.
You were not alone.
No. Dick Daly and I, who was white, another strategy we utilized not to bring any suspicions to what we may have been up to, was after we got close enough to the workers, I had Daly to walk a little bit ahead of me, so it looks as if, white would identify with the white person when whatever we were doing, that the white person was in charge, just by virtue of them walking ahead and turning the head back as if he's giving me some form of instructions or whatnot.
That is so telling of what the time was like, that if a subservient black man is walking behind, it's okay.
It's okay, yes.
This sounds like the planning for a military operation.
Well, that's what we engineered it. It was planned and executed according to the plans that we laid out.
And it was executed according to plan, that being that it was exactly the way that you had drawn it up.
Exactly.
Do you remember what you were thinking and what it felt like when you were 125 feet up, I think?
We wanted to go higher. You see, at the time, the arch, they were working at the 300-foot mark. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be closer to that mark. But then I calculated, knowing back basically that we wanted to be safer. We wanted to be at a distance safe enough from the workers so in the event of an accident or someone falling off of the arch, meaning one of the workers, that the establishment would have been hard put trying to put the blame on the demonstrators. So that was the only reason why we only climbed to 125-foot mark and not even closer. That was all part of the planning as well.
What about the danger of the demonstrators falling off the thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a possibility because the ladder that we climbed up on, it was a cylinder, so there was space behind us. We had to hold on to the steps. We were contemplating there was a platform across from where we were that we could have, it was about 3 or 4 foot distance that we could have jumped over on that platform. I was trying to make up my mind whether or not we should go ahead and run the risk of that, where we could have just kind of relaxed up there because it was a big enough area. We could have just sit there. And then at the time that we wanted to come down, we could have jumped back over and grabbed the ladder and then come down. Only thing is that the wind was a little breezy up there, and I was wondering whether or not we should run that risk or not, and I decided that we better let well enough alone and not run that risk.
What were you seeing when you looked out? I mean, you had the demonstration in the background, the diversionary demonstration going on. Workers must have been saying, what the heck's going on here?
Well, you had that. I mean, it was a lot of curiosity, a lot of curious activity that was going on from the workers. And every so often, I had binoculars myself. And so I looked over from the arch over toward the old courthouse, and I could see the picketing going on over there. And then every so often I would move my arm up and down just to try to make sure that they would see that we were on the arch. And then I also saw where the picket line was breaking up. So I suspected that they were going to bring the picket line over to the arch grounds where we were. And sure enough, that's what happened. And then, of course, the police then all came, and then they prevented the picketers from getting any closer to where we were.
Was there any kind of a negotiation with you to come on down?
Oh, yes. They had a policeman right after we gained access and we got reached the mark where we were. They sent a policeman up to try to talk us down, you know. But we had already decided what we were going to do. We told the police we was going to stay there until 100 black people were hired in decent paying jobs and contractors. Now, they had no idea whether we were going to come down, but we had already factored in that I was going to come down at a certain time because I had to be at work at 12 o'clock midnight. But they didn't know that. So the time that Daly and I had already calculated, and we had already worked out with the bonds person about the approximate time that we would come down, and we knew we were going to be arrested. And so consequently, at that time, around, I believe it was either 5 or 6 o'clock, we decided to come down. And then, of course, they had the policemen there and all, and we went limp because we refused to walk to jail, which is another reason why things were kind of delayed. Because at the time that we come down, they thought that we were just going to walk to jail. But then after they placed me on the rest and I went to the ground, then that's when the press was there, they decided to call the cruiser. After I was arrested first, they never arrested at the time. They didn't put Daly under arrest. And it's not until at the last moment somebody recognized that he was also part of the demonstration. And then when they arrested him, he too went limp, and they had to put both of us on the stretchers and took us to jail. And then we were bonded out. And then that gave me, I guess, after a couple of hours, and then that gave me time enough to get home and shower and get to work before 12 o'clock midnight.
So you made it to the job on time.
On time.
This is a very well-planned operation. Is there any part of it that didn't go according to plan?
I didn't expect that 30 days afterwards I would be unemployed. McDonald fired me in that case, and me being fired, that led to the Green versus McDonald case.
Supreme Court case.
The Supreme Court case. The other part is interesting that we didn't plan on, and that was Nicholas Kassenbach was the attorney general for Kennedy, and he dropped the charges. I mean, that was something that we didn't expect. We expected we were going to be back in the court, and it's going to be another one of those hullabaloos. But when they learn about us climbing the arch and why, and apparently the National Park Service couldn't justify, our rationale for doing it, and so they dropped the charges on us.
What were the charges specifically?
Besides general peace, it was peace disturbance on federal property and I think resisting arrest. And it was about three charges. I can't remember what the others were.
Just going back to the time on the arch, I know the police tried to talk you down. The officer tried to talk you down. Did anybody try to physically get you?
No. They wouldn't dare. Well, I just didn't. We calculated that we didn't think that they would run the risk of trying to force us down because we were going to resist the arrest at that particular point.
We're talking with civil rights activist Percy Green about his demonstration at the St. Louis Arch back in 1964. We'll be back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back with civil rights activist Percy Green, we're talking about the demonstration at the St. Louis Arch in 1964, in which he took part, his protest for equal employment rights. Percy, was the mission accomplished?
I think for all practical purposes, yes and no. And I say that because at the time, there were about three contractors that got work there. Arthur Kennedy was a sheet metal company, and I think he got a contract. Harding Electric was a black contractor. He got some work, I think. And I think it was one other black contractor whose name escapes me at this time. And then, of course, it was a few blacks that got, you know, some employment. I mean, you know, was hired. Now, the only thing is that, you know, I view that as tokenism. And I know your next question is, what about now? Yeah. Well, I think that the tokenism is just a little larger. But nonetheless, I don't think that there's adequate employment, or that blacks are getting adequate employment in terms of construction as well as contracts, as well as jobs across the board. But since we're talking about construction, I certainly don't think that that there's been enough effort. I mean, because you see, one is this, Don. See, most of these jobs, I think, people can learn and learn these jobs on the job training. Most people have the ability to learn. Some can learn faster than others and so on and so forth, but people can learn. Blacks and whites can learn. So it seems like to me that if the military can draft people, at the time that I was doing all of this, blacks were being part of the draft, system that we had in place. And the draft system, after you got a certain age, whether you're black or white, the system drafted you. You went into a military. You then was exposed to weapons and systems that you never saw before. And in 8 weeks, you was proficient in being utilized to fight for this country. So that means that you had to be qualified in order. They wouldn't send unqualified people to fight for this country. Otherwise, it would have been taken over. So you had to be qualified to fight for this country. So it's interesting that when this country wants to utilize you in a matter for its best interest, it will take a person, qualify them, and then utilize them. But yet and still, when it comes to making a livelihood for yourself, you don't have that same type of interest. So I think that you should have both. Certainly, first and foremost, is that a person should have the wherewithal to make a livelihood, to become a productive citizen. A livelihood then translates into being able to convert or develop your family, your siblings into productive citizens, and so it goes. But if you don't allow for blacks to that same right and the same benefits of being a citizen of this country, then it's broken. The system is broken. And so therefore demonstrations, I think, and I'm still a strong advocate for civil disobedience, to move people out of the comfort zone so they can begin to see the issue for what it is.
Where are the greatest deficiencies now? Is it construction? Is it just general? Is it overall? Is there one area in particular?
It's economics. I think that it's mainly jobs. But I think that the basic deficiencies is in blacks or people of color having the ability to be able to construct their family unit. And that starts with the economics, being able to have a decent paying job. So that means the parents. Now, I know a lot of people feel that they want to put the emphasis on children. But I think first and foremost, the family unit starts with the parent. The parent has to have the ability to make a decent salary so they would be the ones to be able to provide for their children. And then the children would be able to look and have some form of respect for the parent because they know that the parent is the one that is providing for them. And then, of course, then having decent and good parents would allow for them to have a model to look at when they grow up, become of age, they too can mimic what a family structure is like and would begin to, you know, do the same. And I think there's too much emphasis has been placed on all kinds of other things rather than dealing with the parent, the family unit, the father, mother configuration. And then I think that's where the emphasis should be placed in terms of the economics.
So we're right back to where you started. You started with your concern about jobs back in 1964 and before.
Yes.
And your concern today is still about it.
Still about jobs, yeah.
Still about jobs.
Yeah.
Again, I'd like to return back to 64 if I could, because I, you know, you made mention of the fact that the media was very quick to come in and watch what was going on back in that time. How about the media response immediately after? Was the media at all in your corner? How did they treat the story?
Well, it was mixed, I believe. You see, my strategy was always to inform the media that there was going to be some arrests. The media was always, seemingly, that it was always interested in, especially black folks, being arrested and whatnot. And so, therefore, I, when the moment that I said, emphasized, say, hey, some people here are going to be arrested, well, then that usually gets the attention of getting them there. And then, of course, once I say that, I want to accommodate, you know, I had to accommodate them because I did have folks already prepared and willing to be arrested and whatnot, you know. So that was part of the jujitsu that we had to utilize in order to get the press attention. Now, if we had just announced that we had a proclamation or we had something that we would like to read or hold a press conference about wrongdoing that we think is taking place here, this, here, there, or elsewhere, they would not have come. It would have been no news. I mean, so I had to put some spice in it, yeah, jazz it up a little bit, and then, of course, they always reported that, well, John Jones was arrested, or Percy Green was arrested again for doing this, that, and the other, and action people did this, that, and the other, and so forth.
What about editorializing? Did the Post or the Globe Democrat, did they take sides in this thing? Or
well, I'm glad you brought that up. Well, of course, you know, the Globe Democrat demonized me. You know, they always created me as if I was a person that had horns and whatnot, you know. The Post-Dispatch, sometime they the editorial was so-so, but it wasn't a whole lot of a difference other than the adjectives that they used. You know, some the Globe Democrat was they used some very harsh language, and then of course the Post-Dispatch they used maybe not so harsh, but nonetheless. There was no fans of the protesters.
Well, I know there was a period of time where Percy Green was almost like public enemy number one.
That's what I mean. As you can see, what a nice person I am right here now, even though I still believe in disruption and civil disobedience.
How much do you think you've accomplished, Percy Green, during these last, I hate to say it, 50-plus years?
50 years, wow. Yeah. On one hand, I think that there have been some successes. You do have some blacks in areas that blacks have not been in before. But again, though, Don, it's tokenism. You see, it's not, and a good example of that is what we have here with Ferguson or whatnot, you know. And then you have groups now that have formed, and people are very hostile toward it, almost the same as they was hostile against action. When you hear, black folks hear, when white folks hear the term Black Lives Matter, that drives many whites up the wall, you know. Well, it was like when Action was carrying on its activities and whatnot. You know?
Let me just explain to the audience what Action is. Action is the Action Council to Improve Opportunities for Negroes. That's your organization.
Yes. Right.
So go ahead, continue.
And so I'm just saying that when you carry on, you know, even civil disobedience, nonviolence, you still have whites that feel as if those people need to be put in prison or in jail indefinitely and whatnot. They don't appreciate the character of nonviolence and whatnot. And then, of course, occasionally there become collateral damage, I mean, that you had in terms of Ferguson, where some things can get out of kelter, get out of order. But the overall emphasis is on civil disobedience. And then, of course, when you have, now, in terms of police behavior, it was the same now. There hadn't been hardly any changes in that behavior then versus now. Because I can tell you some stories about how some of us was treated on the demonstrations.
You know? Well, I think we're well familiar with the stories. We had Bob Gibson was in the studio a week or two ago and talking about in his heyday the way he was treated.
And
I mean it is at every level. I think those have been well documented. Our time is beginning to wind down now. One of the things I wanted to bring up at the very end was the fact that, except for Bernie Hayes, a radio guy, a long time, you'd have been pretty much ignored during this whole 50th anniversary of the Arch. I mean, you played a pretty significant role in the story as it evolved, and yet Percy Green, well, let's not invite him to this or that.
Well, that's right. I mean, that kind of says something about whether the attitudes or among decision makers or whatnot, you see. And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. You would think that folks would cherish in the way that we chose to try to bring about change nonviolently, as opposed to the way other people in the world bring about change as a result of armed revolution or whatnot, you see. But, it's just unfortunate. And then, of course, I mean, the extension of that, I mean, still advocating for civil disobedience to bring about change. Of course, I mean, you start off with trying to negotiate and appeal to people's better judgment. But if that doesn't work, then you have to have a little nudging, and then, of course, trying to involve other people and move them out of the comfort zone so they, too, can get into the mix. But, yes, it is unfortunate that besides, Bernie Hayes, he made mention of it and raised a question. And then, as an afterthought, the people that were dealing with the Arch celebration, they first of all claimed that they didn't know how to get in contact with me, and then later they were shared information. And then, of course, once that effort was put forth, I would not deny it. I mean, even though I wasn't that enthused that they were going to invite me in the first place, but since they did, I reciprocated.
And that was at the ceremony last Saturday.
Yes,
you were a part of
that. But I think it's only fair to point out that it was Bernie Hayes in his article, and then Chris King from the St. Louis American began to wanted to find out why and what have you. And then, of course, Eric Vickers, he too was interested as well. And so between those folks, and then others that I may not even, that I just don't know, begin to start inquiring, and I think that was what triggered them at least asking me or to acknowledge that, my presence.
Well, Percy Green, we're happy to acknowledge the role that you've played, a very important role back in 1964, a long time ago. A lot has happened since then, but there's a lot yet to happen, a lot of work still to be done.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us.
All right. Thank you.
Longtime civil rights activist Percy Green, whose protest at the Arch in 1964 was a key moment in the U.S. civil rights movement. The protest was against the lack of black construction workers at the arch. Green was later fired from his job at McDonnell Douglas because of his demands for more jobs for blacks there. It eventually led to a major anti-discrimination and employment suit and ultimately a favorable Supreme Court ruling on that issue. Coming up, Susan Saarinen, the daughter of the man who designed the arch, Eero Saarinen. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU.